Accession number 14974, Paul Armstrong, Rail 6.
Mr. P. Armstrong, Rail 6. Mr. P. Armstrong, Rail 6. You were describing some of the training that you were undergoing in the Chipping Norton, Mr. Armstrong.
Yeah, perhaps I should explain a little bit. I haven't made myself very clear to you. The training was initiated by our adjutant, the regular officer, Captain Jeffries, who was, in my opinion, extremely able. He had the four company commanders with him, and they had their maps out in covered with chinagraph. And he told each company commander where his company was going to operate, where they were moving from, and where the objective was. The company commander marked this on the map and then moved off to see his three platoon commanders. And each platoon commander was given a route, a starting point, and a finishing point, and the axis that he was supposed to work on. Having got this information, you could expect to have senior officers wandering about behind you, observing whether your troops were carrying out the various tasks that they were set. The piece of ground normally you hadn't seen before, but you had an ordnance survey map which showed the land in question, and you marked it on your map board and went along to your sergeant and conferred with him and your three corporals. Having done that, you decided what sort of way you were going to operate. Sometimes the land was such that you had to move literally in single file over certain areas, but you had to work out where each movement was going to take place and in what formation. And this is why the subaltern, the commander, should be well forward so that he can find out if there are any obstacles, any problems arising on the way, for instance, streams, wild animals, and various things like this. So you can picture then, you move off at a certain time, and the adjutant will expect you to reach the point that he has said at a certain time, and observers will be watching to see how you use cover and whether you are using your troops to cover one another in using this cover, so that it becomes a rather trying time for the subaltern. And that is where we come back to the old problem of the batman, who is following him on as his orderly, who runs to give messages if necessary, and generally acts as his deputy. I must say, the ground where we were in Chipping Norton area was very, very good for infantry tactics. There was lots of cover, there were lots of open fields, one had to use hedgerows so that formations could be changed and had to be changed as we're walking along. There were streams to one paddle through. All sorts of things happened. And at the end of that time, it became rather a competition to see which platoon was better than the others. And although at the end of the day a discussion took place in the officers' mess about the whole of the battalion performance, individual officer by individual officer, you can be sure that the same thing took place in the sergeant's mess and amongst the men themselves in the NAFI, a lot of ribald comments. I remember once being terribly embarrassed by being complimented by the adjutant. Captain Jeffries said 18 platoon carried out an absolutely marvellous performance today. No thanks to the officer in charge. Everybody shrieked with laughter. I had to laugh too, because I must be honest, my sergeant, Joe Makepeace, enlisted giving his profession as poacher. And Joe Makepeace was a good soldier. Joe Makepeace survived all the whole of the war until disbandment of the battalion in 45 in Berlin.
The pace of movement, you're talking about advancing, was that any quicker than the normal infantry, because you were light infantry? Did you move more quickly?
In fire and movement, you you don't move very quickly if you are trying to advance to all intents and purposes unobserved and with the loss of as few men as you possibly can. Where the light infantry comes into it is when you're doing marching from A to B. And I remember when we were retraining after Dunkirk, when I was with the 2nd Arums, we had to, once a month, we had to do 100 miles in 3 days, sleeping out, of course, during that time, in full service marching order, FSMO. And I found it simple enough, because I was very fit, but it tried a lot of people. And our colonel had a habit then, Ivor Vier had a habit then of, if you didn't arrive in time, the time laid down, you were sent out the next day to do another 33 miles to make sure that you did. Because when you arrived at the end of the 100 miles, it was expected that you came up the high street at the double.
The training that you were doing with the platoon and section level, how was that related to extending it to company and then battalion?
After a short while, too short really, the platoons had to work as a company, using exactly the same thing, except that it was one or two platoons up and same sort of formation as we've talked about in respect of the platoon. The company was doing the same. You can think of the platoon as an arrowhead, with at the base of the arrowhead, at the beginning of the movement, there's the sergeant and the signaller, when you've got a wireless, and the RAMC personnel, they at the centre, the base of the arrowhead, moving up behind you, and the sergeant watching to see if anything happens to the officer, whose place he will naturally take in the event of any unfortunate accident. The same sort of formation occurred with relation to the company. One the company commander would say and decide whether he would have you going up Arrowhead or otherwise, as we've mentioned, for the platoon. And at the base of his arrow would be the sergeant major, the signalers, and any medical staff that he might have. In other words, the headquarter group. Later on, we got comical things like the boy's anti-tank rifle, an absurd piece of machinery which was generally thrown away. We had a 2-inch mortar, which was useful and not too heavy, except to the man carrying it. And we had as well the MT department. There should be a vehicle somewhere about. At that time, there wasn't. Then, if you go further back, you find the battalion, the colonel with his staff, and in our case, relying very, very much on the adjutant, they were moving, deciding how the company moved, the battalion moved up, whether it would go up in two or in one or whatever order the directors thought of doing. And it's interesting to project that from the battalion to the three battalions, making the brigade, how the brigade was going to operate, and then the three brigades, how the division was going to operate. It's theoretically a well-oiled machine, but in all machines, there can be sand in the works.
What might be the influences that decided you on a given shape, arrowhead, line, or...
Oh, the lay of the land. The lay of the land and where the enemy was supposed to be. Because in all of the training, there were supposed to be, and generally were, observing officers. And they were at your your destination. And they were observing how often you were exposed to view, how often it could be seen which way you were advancing, how little advantage you took of cover. All these sort of things were observed. And this is why at the inquest, battalion inquest afterwards, all of this was gone over.
Can we start to talk about the way that sections were organized? There were three sections to a platoon.
Yes.
In the section, what would be the organization of the section?
Normally a section would be a corporal, a lance corporal, and eight men, private soldiers. And that's 3 10s of 30. Then you have the orderly sergeant, and with luck, you had a lance sergeant as his kind of replacement. There was the batman. There was, with the platoon, we didn't in those days have any signalling apparatus. You should have had. And there was supposed to be an MT orderly. We hadn't in those days. And there was the man who had the 2-inch mortar, which he was supposed to carry, and this frightful boys, which was a long-barreled 0.5 firing, armor-piercing bullet, which, I may tell you, bounced off tanks.
And was it difficult to fire?
It had a recoil equal to about 16 mules. And the first time it was fired in our battalion, the man broke his collarbone. And it was then they learnt that you had to hug it as tightly as you could and pray. The most absurd piece of mechanism I've ever seen in my life.
Did you have a stretcher bearer or a medical orderly with you to a platoon? They were under company orders,
generally speaking.
The weapons of the section, were they all riflemen?
No. The weapons of the section were, the officer was supposed to be equipped with a pistol. I went to war in full, I had no battle dress, I was wearing service dress, putties and breeches. I had no pistol, I had no binoculars, but I had a walking stick.
The rest of the section?
The men. Each man had a rifle, but there was also one of the men had a light machine gun, the Bren, which actually was a very, very necessary piece of equipment. And then we also had the man with the 2-inch mortar, a small mortar that two of them set up. And it depended on the platoon commander and the sergeant discussing together where in the platoon you would put the LMG. I think we had an LMG to each section at one time, but I'm sorry to say I can't. Memory plays me false these days. But it was all carried, and it took a lot of persuading a man carrying, for instance, a 2-inch mortar to crawl down a ditch to avoid being seen. And this is the sort of thing that we found later on the Germans were better at, but I must say the Germans had been preparing for several years. And when we met them, had done several campaigns. So, to me, it was a miracle that our men did so well.
The firepower of a platoon must have been quite considerable.
Yes, and that was one good thing about the training. The training beforehand, while they were territorials, before they were embodied, we used to be on the range regularly, and it was a point of honour that your men were not only good at shooting, they were fast. And one always was reminded of the Great War, of how the regular people literally showed the Germans that it was rifle fire and not machine gun fire that they were using. So we tried very, very hard, and all the officers had to take the same sort of excuse me, training at both the rifle and the Bren, and indeed the mortar. We were expert at all of those things, so that we could you were trained so that you could strip the Bren and reassemble it and carry on firing blindfold. And this was a point of honour that you could do as good as anyone in your platoon.
What kind of, or what amount of ammunition would a man be carrying in a section of a platoon?
Normally, 50 rounds per man was all we normally carried, but they were supposed to be coming up behind. But 50 rounds per man.
And the Bren gun ammunition, obviously you needed.
The Bren gun ammunition, it was in, you'll have seen these curved, that held 29 rounds. And he carried he carried two spares, and his second in, there was a number two, his number two also carried two spares. I think we had more later on, but once again I would have to look back at notes to see.
The division at this time was supposed to be motorised.
Not then.
You hadn't got the
they were assembling the vehicles then. It was it was after Christmas before we were getting vehicles in any appreciable quantities. And we had the most frightful experience you possibly have never been in Oxfordshire in winter. But Oxfordshire in winter is extremely cold. And one night, don't forget, this was in the days before antifreeze. One night, all but five vehicles in the division were frozen and immobilized. And that taught us a sharp lesson.
We were
trained to get on climb into the transport, buses for instance, or trucks, by the order M bus. And for a long time we had marked on the ground the shape of the vehicle we were getting into, and had to practice getting into this imaginary vehicle at top speed. Which caused a lot of hilarity.
What speeds did you get up to getting in and out of the vehicle when you actually had them to get into, of course?
I can't recall the exact time, but it was extremely fast. And they got out a lot faster. Yeah, very, very quick indeed. You'd be surprised how fast people get into a vehicle. Interestingly enough, we were also taught how to, when we got the trucks, mainly things like Bedfords and Dodges, we were taught how to jump out them while the trucks were still going. They used to slow down to about 15, 20 miles an hour, and you were taught to jump out of those, keep running, and be able to fire at somebody as soon as you regained the top kneeling position.
Were there accidents?
Oh, yes, regularly. Yes, but one didn't bother much. In fact, I used to be amused at my chaps discussing, don't forget they were almost all ex-miners, discussing whether it were better to lose a leg or an arm.
What other responsibilities did a subaltern like yourself have within the battalion?
You were solely responsible for your men. And, for instance, when they paraded in the morning, first thing, you were sergeant and inspected them, but you also should inspect them. If you were in a hurry, it was just naturally an ordinary common law garden inspection. If you weren't in a hurry, or they were going to go into any special parade, you were, for instance, you looked at the boots. I often used to make them take a boot off and let you look at the socks. Used to make them lay the kit out to see that all the kit was there. And particularly at the end of a route march, every man's feet had to be examined automatically, whoever he was. If he'd marched, he had to show his feet. And in the early days, we lost one or two people because the doctors possibly hadn't seen things like hammer toes and the rest of it, which literally prevented them from marching the distances they were expected to, and to the conditions that they were exposed to. Any doubts about a man? It was insisted that he go up to see the MO, and the MO was pretty thorough. I must be honest with you as well in saying that we were blessed with a very good padre at that time. I don't know, I lost sight of them afterwards, but he was very helpful. He went around and he looked after men's problems before any action. He looked after them extremely well.
What was his name?
Rice was the one I was thinking about, but he was this, you see, I was in several battalions. I can't remember that one.
The first duty, before even seeing it yourself, was to look at your men.
Oh, yes. Yes. That was essential.
And that was strictly enforced.
Strictly enforced. If you were on the march and you were going to sleep the night out, for instance, it was your duty to make sure that every man was inside some sort of a bivouac. They had ground sheets, which they wore as a mac, a coil with rings on the corners, and it was generally two men used to work together. One put his ground sheet on the bottom and one put it above, and made bivouacs out of that. And those people with a little bit of initiative, obviously, if they could find shelter, they found shelter. And good luck to them. But at the end of that time, you had to go back and make sure, hope that you were Batman and found a place for you. He obviously found a place for himself first, but he had a place for you. And I can't ever remember being let down in all my service.
Other duties as an officer, I'm thinking of company battalion duties, orderly, that kind of
thing. If you were concentrated, one had different duties for different circumstances, but there was always an orderly officer of the day, and he was on duty, strictly speaking, a 24-hour stretch, because he was at battalion headquarters sitting at the telephone and has to be available for the whole of the 24 hours, the orderly officer. And if you'd done anything that the colonel disapproved of, you might be given 3 days orderly officer as a punishment. And that, I must say, wasn't very very amusing. I had it.
And what had you done to get it?
Interestingly enough, I'd criticised the regimental sergeant major.
And was this because of his duties or lack of duties? Or?
I thought he interfered with a duty that I'd been told to carry out. And although I gather that the CO had some sympathy with me, the position of the RSM was such that he hadn't to be shown to be blamed.
Who was RSM?
I was young in the service.
Who was RSM at this time?
I asked you last week when we were there, and I'm still... I can only remember him as Joe. It's silly of me, but there are lapses in your memory.
And this would be Colonel Miller at this time.
Yes, Colonel Miller, with Peter Jeffries as the adjutant. Yeah.
As the officer on duty, what exactly were you doing? Other than sitting beside the telephone, what other duties did you have within the 24 hours?
You inspected the guard, because, again, if it's a battalion or the officer, there's a full quarter guard, and they're on duty, as you will imagine, all night.
What's a quarter guard?
It's a full guard of... it isn't a platoon. The quarter guard was a platoon, I beg your pardon. The quarter guard is a platoon, but there's only a section at a time out. The other two sections are resting, waiting to be called. And they're every 4 hours, they're called out to take duty. 2 hours. And it's overlapping, so that no man is out more than 2 hours at a time, so that they don't become sleepy. And you have a sergeant in charge of that guard. And it gets to ridiculous limits when, for instance, our quarter guards used to be inspected in one battalion so very thoroughly that I had men carried out onto the parade because we were shot down because three of our men were accused of being barefooted. One had lost a heel plate and the other had lost a stud each. And they were put on a charge for that.
So the turnout was still extremely high.
Very, very high indeed.
And within the guard itself that you were inspecting as it part of your duty, there was the stick man.
That's right. This is why I was up for 3 days, because I had chosen a stick man, and the RSM said he, another person, should be the stick man. And of course I told him that I had already chosen the stick man, and he took umbrage.